Chapter 9. The Search, the Find, and the Buggering Off. Today. The staff at Buckingham Palace were in disarray. Everything was meant to run like clockwork, but the day's order of events had come to an abrupt and awkward halt. The Queen's impromptu meeting had thrown the whole afternoon off schedule. They covered for Her Majesty as best they could, but they were fast running out of excuses. The Prime Minister had been told that she was feeling a little ill. The dignitaries from Mongolia had been told that she would be joining them in the gardens as soon as possible. Charles was put on waving duty. Adam and Pete were in the opposite of disarray. They both felt quite arrayed. They had loved the Queen's speech of her coronation, and Adam was bloody impressed that she had figured the whole thing out. "I'm bloody impressed," he told Her Majesty while devouring a large slice of Victoria sponge. "You know, you're the first one to make the connection. First royal, I mean."
"Just how many royals have you fraternised with?" asked the Queen, taking a sip of tea.
"Of England? 12. "Including myself," said Adam, with a wink. The Queen looked at him coyly as she reached for an iced bun.
"Quite. So, what do you want?"
Adam leaned back. He was becoming more and more impressed with this woman by the minute.
"How do you know I want anything?" replied Adam, trying to seem mysterious.
"Because that is your pattern. You turn up out of nowhere, looking for something, find it, and then sooner or later bugger off," the Queen stated coolly.
Adam was quite taken aback to hear the everlasting quest that was his life summed up so brusquely. Pete, who was somewhat more transparent in his desires, helped himself to another slice of cake. He always overate when anxious, and was beginning to get a little jumpy. Her Majesty may be taking today's bizarre events in her stride, but how long would her royal handlers remain civil? He decided to cut to the chase.
"We're looking for Vivian. We thought you might know where she is, or at least have her last location in your confessional."
The Queen raised an eyebrow. "Pete, I was enjoying myself there," said Adam, throwing up his arms in faux outrage. "It's not every day I get to flirt with a Queen."
"I can assure you I was not flirting," replied the Queen,
summoning up a corgi next to her, who had stationed himself at Pete's feet, hopeful for crumbs.
"Why are you looking for her now, after all this time?"
Adam leant forward and put on his most solemn of faces. "Your Majesty, you have read my tales, and as you have realised, in nearly all of them I am indeed looking for something. My true goal has always been the same. I am searching for my wife. She was taken from me, long before your book existed, before books existed. I have lived day by day scouring this world and countless others trying to find her. I have failed more times than...
I don't think we have time for the whole story, my boy," Pete interjected.
"Right, sorry, quick version. Yesterday, after centuries of dead ends, I got my first real lead. A name, a location. I need the sword, Vivian's sword, to help me find it. You see, the sword also works as..."
"As a compass. Yes, I know. I have read the book. But I'm sorry to say that the Lady of the Lake left England over 100 years ago."
The Queen saw her guests exchange anxious looks. She continued,
"An attempt was made by the family to claim the sword in 1917, at the height of the First World War. We believed it was the hour of England's greatest need. She disagreed. I believe my grandfather has the exact quote, if you would be so kind as to follow me into my bedchamber."
Adam raised his eyebrows. "Now you're definitely flirting," he grinned. The four of them walked down the grand corridor in silence. The Queen led, followed by Pete and Adam, plus a very content corgi with a French fancy bringing up the rear. The Queen opened the door to her most private rooms and invited them in. Seeing it with fresh eyes, she realized that the bedchamber had hardly changed since the night of her coronation. The bed was the same, the wallpaper, the curtains, and the boxes. On the desk, one red, one black.
"If you ever tell anyone you are here, I'll put you both in the tower."
It wasn't clear whether she was joking or not. They weren't in a hurry to find out. Both of them had been imprisoned before, by mortals and gods. Neither wished to repeat the experience.
You have our word, Pete reassured her.
The Queen moved towards the desk, Adam and Pete keeping a respectful distance, though they both heard the satisfying click of the black case from which she retrieved the confessional. The Queen sat down and began turning the pages.
"I suppose I shall be making a new entry after today. How exciting," she said, almost to herself. "Ah, here we are. 1st of July, 1917. The lady stood before me, visibly agitated. My man Wilkins took dictation as she spoke. Oh, piss right off, you bunch of inbred twats."
"That's Vivian," said Adam and Pete in unison. The Queen looked up at them, but with a nod from Pete, she continued to read.
"And it goes on roughly in the same manner. Using language that would make a sailor blush, I've had enough of this horse shit. I'm taking it with me," she declared. "And then fog rolled in very suddenly. We heard the sound of an oar in water, and she was gone. I fear for my country. So many men. So many boys."
The Queen stopped reading and closed the book.
"I'm afraid he gets a little macabre after that."
Adam felt a knot in his stomach. This was typical, just typical. Every time he got a step closer, some new obstacle popped up. Without thinking, he flung himself onto the Queen's four-poster bed. He stared at the ceiling, an involuntary pout on his lips. So, after 2,000 years, she finally decides to move. I told her to leave so many times, she never did, and now, just when I need her, she's gone, Adam said through gritted teeth. She could be in any bloody lake, in any bloody world. Adam buried his head in his hands.
Now, let's not fly off the handle. Let's work with what we know, said Pete in what was clearly meant to be soothing tones.
He was always amazed that though Adam was so old, he could still act like one of his petulant first years.
Your friend is right. There's no need for an outburst, the Queen said calmly.
Adam kept his hands to his face. He knew he was being rude, but he was feeling very grumpy, and he felt sure that nothing in the world could cheer him up.
I have quite a good idea of where she is, continued the Queen.
Well, not nothing. Adam lowered one hand slowly, revealing a sceptical grey eye. The Queen smiled, gesturing to a large tapestry covering the entire west wall of the room. It depicted the Greek goddess Athena, looking down on the ancient city of Athens. Her face was proud, her long brown hair visible under the helm that rested on her brow. Pete looked at the tapestry and gave a little sigh. He'd always loved Athens, the earthly birthplace of his cherished democracy. He must remember to visit before the end of the world.
Mr. Pete, was it? Would you be a dear and pull up that rope?
Pete shook himself from his reverie and quickly obliged. Giving the cord to the side of the tapestry a gentle tug, Athena and Athens mechanically rolled up at surprising speed, exposing the wall behind.
Philip calls this my little obsession, the Queen said, with an uncharacteristic giggle.
Adam sat bolt upright. The tapestry had moved away to reveal a bizarre collage, world maps of various ages and types, covered in newspaper clippings and post-it notes. Different coloured string joined the notes at different points around the world, forming a strange spider web. The Queen looked triumphant. "What is this?" said Pete, fascinated by the display. "This is me trying to work out every story laid down in that book. Where did the dragons go? Do we need to fear the wandering King Sabine? Does the pact still hold, or are there signs of fey attack? Nearly every entry in the confessional contains a possible threat to my country. Should one arise again, I need to know how to advise my government." Adam stared at her, surprised to find himself momentarily speechless. Pete said what they were both thinking.
"This is quite a feat, Your Majesty."
Pete was peering at an article pinned in the middle of the ocean, on which the Queen had, in her most delicate hand, written, "Kraken." "As you know, I believe the Lady of the Lake was alluded to in the quotations from my grandfather's account in the confessional. I also believe she was referenced in a Wall Street Journal article. The article in question, published on the 2nd of July, 1916, reported a sudden, unexplained fog in the middle of Manhattan in the early hours of the morning. As there has been no evidence of her anywhere else since, I therefore deduce that the Lady of the Lake, Vivian, holder of the sword Excalibur, currently resides in Central Park, New York City." Pete had moved to study the article himself. Adam was now right on the edge of the bed, excitement coursing through every fibre of his being. Neither of these reactions fazed the Queen. She was in full flow. This was what Elizabeth had thought being Queen should be like when she was a little girl all those years ago. "You," she directed this to Adam, who immediately stood up, "you will take my plane. You will find her, so that she may aid you in your quest. And you will relay my most humble apologies for the actions of one's predecessors. Do you accept?" Her cheeks were slightly flushed now. Adam knelt before the Queen of England. He looked up, his grey eyes fixed on hers. "Yes, Your Majesty." "What's a plane?" The Queen stood alone in her bedroom, examining her little obsession. The feeling of exhilaration had not left her. It had been an absolute delight to meet the mystery man who had intrigued her so, and to actually be able to assist him in his quest. How thrilling! The Queen took out the black book and sat down at her desk, turning to the first blank page. Today was meant to be one of nothing but smiling and waving, but instead, a one-time predecessor kicked down my door looking for his sword. A man with dark skin and storm-like eyes. I was right. It is the same man. The same man in all the stories. Feeling shattered, she retired to bed, but continued to write out the entirety of her interaction with the two men from start to finish. By the stroke of midnight, she was asleep, book still in hand, enjoying a near-perfect slumber with the most exciting of dreams. They were in a Rolls-Royce, purring towards Heathrow Airport. Adam had never been in a car before. It did feel a lot safer than a horse, and a damn sight more comfortable. He thought he still preferred the train. You could stretch your legs and have a wander on a train, but this was still pleasant. Despite their speed, night had fallen by the time they arrived. Most of the scheduled flights for the day had already left. Adam had nearly jumped out of his skin when he saw his first jumbo jet touching down on the tarmac. The Queen's plane was at least far more modest in size. If the crew's strange new passengers unnerved them, they did not show it. Both Adam and Pete were welcomed in by a charming-looking fellow in a sharp suit and, Adam couldn't help but notice, a rather fetching hat. He offered to take their coats. Pete handed his over, but Adam politely declined. He had gone through a lot to get his golden armour back, and he didn't intend to let it out of his sight. They sat down in soft chairs and were immediately brought sparkling wine and nuts. A calming voice in a soft, Edinburgh Lilt welcomed them on board the Queen's flight. Just as Adam discovered, much to his delight, that his seat could go all the way back, he was asked to put it upright for takeoff. "Are you sure this is safe?" Adam asked Pete.
"For the most part. Statistically speaking, it is actually the safest way to travel," Pete said, gazing out of the window.
Adam himself was momentarily distracted by the screen at the front of the cabin, telling him what to do in case anything went wrong. Why would they have that if nothing ever went wrong? The plane began to pick up speed, and Adam almost immediately began to regret the wine and nuts. Pete had spent most of the journey to the airport filling Adam in on the advancements in human aviation technology, but all the description in the world couldn't prepare Adam for the actual sensation of jet-propelled flight.
If you think you're going to be sick, they provide a little bag for that, Pete said helpfully.
Adam rallied himself. He'd fallen into London through the breach that very day. Surely he could keep his composure on this aircraft. This was something people did all the time. Adam came out of the bathroom about 20 minutes into their flight. Pete had a strong cup of tea waiting for him. They talked for hours. Adam brought Pete up to speed on all of his recent adventures, leaving out the details that might worry him.
"So, I arrive on Jotunheim, and it's freezing. I mean, at first I think I've taken the wrong branch and I'm back on Niflheim. The snow is piling up all around me, and in the distance I see this mountain. I'm hoping for a cave or, at the very least, something to keep the wind off until the blizzard is over. So I start trudging, and the mountain is getting closer and closer, and I start to hear singing. This big bass voice, and as I get closer, I start to make out the words. It's a cooking song. I don't remember much Jotunese, but I can make out meat, spit, and belly. Then the wind changes, and I can smell the food. Now, I've not eaten in about 3 days, and this smell, oh, my mouth is watering. It's fire-cooked beast. I'm getting hints of rosemary. There's a sweetness too. Whoever is cooking, they know what they're doing. Anyway, I get closer, and now I can see the glow of the fire, and it's coming from a cave at the base of the mountain. I finally get to the mouth of the cave, and the heat is amazing. It's like that feeling when you get into the baths after a quick plunge in the frigidarium. All your pores open up to soak in the warmth. But I can't enjoy it for too long, because turning the spit over the fire is this giant. Not the biggest I've ever seen, but a 30-footer at least. Now, I've met many giants. Most of them are a laugh, but I've had a couple rip my arms off. Not pleasant. And they grow back horrifically slowly. So I'm standing there, my head fighting my stomach. But he's seen me. And then he speaks.
"Don't worry, little man. I'm not going to eat you. I've got enough food to satisfy me tonight. Even got some to share, if you'll play a game with me."
So I ponder. The last time I played games with a giant was when me, Thor and Loki, I think that's what he was calling himself at the time, were each set challenges by Jutgarda. I had to race a giant that turned out to be the concept of thought. So I knew that this game may also be fixed. But the fire was warm, and the food smelled so good.
"Games? I love games. What did you have in mind?"
"Hide and seek,"
the giant bellowed. I had to suppress a smile. "Very well, hide and seek it is. Will you hide, or shall I?"
"I always hide. You cover your eyes and count to 100.
And so I did. I covered my eyes and counted. I expected the giant to run out into the blizzard or maybe leap to the top of the mountain above. But when I opened my eyes, I saw him immediately. He was sitting behind a boulder towards the back of the cave, The rock barely came up to his navel. The giant had his hands over the back of his head, which was tucked between his knees, as if that would make him invisible. "Where could the giant be?" I said with mock confusion, and began walking around the cave, being careful to avoid the area with the boulder and the hidden giant. I'm sure I didn't hear him go out of the cave. Maybe he can turn invisible. As I continued my faux confusion, the giant began to laugh. His large back shook up and down to make him even more visible. I continued with this for a good 10 minutes. No good game lasts less than 10 minutes, but eventually I called out, I guess I haven't checked behind that boulder yet. I begin to creep over, and the giant tenses up, willing himself not to be found. I reach over to place my hand on his back, when 4 of the largest fingers I have ever seen wrap around my body and lift me clear out of the cave. I am borne up about 100 feet into the air, face to face with this mammoth giantess.
Mordor!
I hear my giant playmate scream. I was enjoying that. He was a very good seeker. Much better than you. Please don't crush him. Turns out this giant is only 50 years old. A toddler, really. He'd been playing a game of hide and seek with his mother for the past month. So his mum, seeing that I meant no harm to the boy, claps away the blizzard clouds, settles herself at the front of the cave, and we all ate until we couldn't move. Best game of hide and seek I've ever played. Pete heartily enjoyed all of Adam's stories. He was a great audience, and Adam was a natural raconteur, and the plane flew on. They both had a lot of fun ordering food and drink from the onboard kitchen, challenging the staff to recipes they weren't even sure existed anymore. They were pleasantly surprised when the steward brought them a rather good bottle of mead. Adam and Pete stayed up singing ancient Norse drinking ballads until they saw the sun start to rise over the Atlantic Ocean.
"So, how long will this voyage be?" Adam finally yawned, pulling down the shutter over his window. "A week? 2?
"Oh, it will be there in a couple of hours," Pete replied, checking his pocket watch. "We should have tried to sleep a bit earlier, really."
Adam looked over at his old friend, who was miraculously already fast asleep, and felt a tremendous swell of pride for his fellow humans. They had come so far. Pete really had done a fantastic job designing them. Adam closed his eyes and began to sleep, to dream, to remember. Adam was naked. A warm breeze was blowing, and the scent of a woman's hair filled his nostrils. His eyes were closed, but he knew that she was lying next to him. If he reached over, his hand would find her, as naked as he was and smiling. Would he be allowed this dream? Of course not, he never was, for it was no true dream. It was memory, one of his first. The sound of powerful wings beat loudly overhead. By the time Adam opened his eyes, all he could see was her hand reaching out to him, wrapped in thick barbed vines. She was being pulled away into the light, the details of her face obscured by its intensity. The light got even brighter. He tried to get up to run after her, but the same vines that had dragged her away were now digging into his flesh. The more he pulled, the more they tightened. Footsteps. 2 figures, one male and one female, were coming towards him out of the light. No, that was wrong. The light was coming from them, their only distinct features, 2 pairs of white eyes that shone like stars. Storm-like clouds billowed menacingly around the male stranger. No, wrong again. The clouds were coming from the stranger, from his pipe. The figure had just pulled it from his mouth, and clouds were billowing from it with all the force of a raging tempest. The male figure with the star-like eyes squatted in front of Adam.
I love you both. But you chose to take what was not yours and run from me. This, I am sorry to say, I cannot forgive.
The eyes flashed like hot coals being blown on.
But I would like to see this as a teaching moment for the pair of you.
The figure reached out and tousled Adam's hair. Adam could feel the power crackling in that hand and the restraint that held anger at bay. The female figure stepped forward. The clouds that poured from her companion's pipe also cascaded down from her head, giving her long storm-made locks. The two clouds coming from these beings danced together, swirling into a great vortex behind them. "It'll be a lesson long in the learning," she said in a calm, regal voice. "I am taking her away. I shall hide her in a place you shall never find. Her punishment, an eternity of isolation, friendless, childless, alone. And yours," she trailed off, turning to her companion. Adam knew what was coming next. He had dreamed this memory so many times. He held his jaws shut tight, but it was no use. The powerful fingers of the male figure forced his mouth open, and Adam tasted fruit from the second tree, the tree of life.
"Adam, you will toil in the fields you so longed to reach. Immortal from this day forth. Your work shall have no end. You will strive fruitlessly. Goodbye."
And with that goodbye, he flicked Adam in the head with such force he felt his neck break and his whole body was launched backwards into the formless space between dreams. A hand grabbed him by the wrist. Instinctively, he reciprocated. But he was not back on the plane. The dreams continued as another, more recent memory began to dance before him. The arm he held felt brittle and malnourished, but still strong enough to support his weight. The arm belonged to the king, the one whom Adam had searched the nine realms looking for, hoping he held the answers or at least a clue to the location of his wife. Adam's hope had proven true. The king's jet-black beard, once so carefully groomed, had grown wild. His coat of delicate flowers had wilted and dried many years ago. His skin was fragile and cracked like old bark on a dying tree. Most of the light had gone out of his lavender eyes. Adam had so desperately wanted to free him. "Jump with me. I can take you home," Adam pleaded. "I am too weak to survive the breach, and I fear death more than imprisonment. But I am patient." Adam wanted more time to argue, to convince, to save. But it was too late. He could hear the large wings beating. He let go of the wrist and ran, the king's last cry ringing in his ears. "Remember the name I have told you. Use the compass the lady still keeps for you. Find the temple and free her." Adam had jumped off the top of creation, his pursuers gaining on him with every beat of those mighty wings. He fell towards the breach, knowing they would not, could not pursue. He awoke with a start. Adam was still on the plane, Pete still sleeping peacefully next to him.
Adam opened the shutter. The morning sun was getting higher outside his little oval window. It had been risky speaking to the imprisoned king. Management would be after him now. They didn't take break-ins lightly. He'd bought some time jumping directly to London from the breach, but he knew it was only a question of when, not if, they'd catch up to him. That was the problem with heaven. Real sticklers for the rules.
You've been listening to Evergreen, Chapter 9, written by Sam Russell and read by Catherine Russell. If you enjoyed it, however you're listening, please give it a rating, a like, a review, or a share so we can get this story into more people's ears. And if you really enjoyed it, you can support this project on our Ko-fi page. All the details can be found on our Twitter, @evergreenbook1. The next chapter comes out on October 4th. Thanks for listening.